This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, we look at the impact of the TV show Seinfeld on the anniversary of its first broadcast run. But first, it's time for our weekly roundup of the top news stories from Wisconsin. While the state's Joint Finance Committee continued to make budget decisions, there were some other major stories affecting Wisconsin this week. State Republicans have scheduled a public hearing for a bill that bans abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy. We look at that bill and when it might see a vote on the floor. Also from the Capitol this week, lawmakers continue to debate the state's prevailing wage law, even though it's unclear if a repeal would make it to the governor's desk. We're joined now by WPR's assistant news director, our Central Time news guy, Noah Ofshinsky. Noah, how's it going?
It's great. It's Friday.
It is indeed. This is always a good thing. Well, it's been another big week for the legislature. What have you been following?
A big week for the state in general. And I know it seems like I say this every week, but this week it has been busy as far as the news goes. Near the top of the list this week, Republican lawmakers have scheduled a public hearing for a bill that, as you just mentioned, bans abortions after 20 weeks. Now, in the past few months, there's been a lot of talk about this kind of bill, but this week it became clear that lawmakers plan to move quickly on this one. And if passed, Wisconsin would join around 12 other states which have enacted similar laws, although several others have been blocked by the court.
What do we know about why lawmakers are advocating for this bill?
Well, if you look around the country, this is the latest strategy used by pro-life groups and lawmakers to further restrict access to abortions. Sponsors of the bill here in Wisconsin say it's needed because there's evidence to suggest that a fetus can actually feel pain at 20 weeks.
And opponents not on that same page, what are they saying?
First, they take issue with the claim that fetuses can feel pain at 20 weeks. They point to various studies that show the opposite. Critics also say women should have the choice, especially in circumstances where there is, something wrong with the fetus. The bill, as it stands now, does not include exceptions for women who are either victims of rape or incest.
And what do we know about where Governor Walker stands on this?
Earlier this year, he said he would sign it. So, again, if it passes the legislature and ends up on the governor's desk, it will become law.
So let's just assume now that it passes the legislature, the governor signs it. Do we anticipate that being a done deal, the end of the story?
No, probably not. I would be surprised if it wasn't challenged in court. Keep in mind that a law passed 2 years ago in Wisconsin that requires abortion providers to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. That has been struck down in court. Now the state is appealing that decision. But I think that probably can serve as something of a preview if this abortion bill is passed.
We're talking right now with Noah Ofshinsky, WPR's assistant news director, a resident news guy here on Central Time, about the top state stories in Wisconsin this week in our state news roundup. And Noah, we saw another big issue come up pretty suddenly this week in the legislature, the prevailing wage law. Where did this one come from?
Right. So the Assembly Labor Committee passed a bill this week that eliminates Wisconsin's prevailing wage law. And this is a law that's been on the books for a while that basically sets a minimum wage for construction workers who work on government projects. Supporters of a full repeal argue that this prevailing wage of sorts sort of artificially drives up the cost of construction projects.
And again, the other side, supporters of the prevailing wage law, what do they have to say?
Well, they say, that this guarantees fair pay and at the same time ensures construction projects are done to a high standard. Democrats argue that if we get rid of this law, that the quality of these construction projects will go down. The fear is that if, this minimum wage is eliminated in order to come in at the lowest bid, a company would actually have to hire workers that are both cheaper and less skilled.
And this isn't quite the first time we've heard of this. A similar effort died in the Senate, right?
Yes. And, that really speaks to the fact that, not all Republicans are on the same page with this bill. GOP leaders in both the Assembly and Senate say they actually don't have the votes to pass it as is in their chambers. That is a full repeal. Now, there is an effort underway to pass some kind of reform short of a full repeal. So that may yet still happen.
Right. And other ways that a repeal or some kind of reform could become a law, how would that happen?
Right. So this law doesn't necessarily, or this bill doesn't necessarily have to go to the full chamber for a vote. It could actually be inserted in the budget by the Joint Finance Committee, which is actually meeting as we speak. So that is still a possibility. It would be much harder to vote down a full repeal if it's actually attached to all the other things that are included in the budget.
And again, comes down to the governor signing it. So has he weighed in on this?
Again, the answer is yes. Governor Walker has indicated he would sign a full repeal of the prevailing wage law.
And we're going to wrap up now with some news out of Chippewa County that gets at some of the sticking points related to the use of drones that's been sort of a societal debate lately. What happened in Chippewa County?
Right. So leaving the Capitol for a few minutes here, I actually found the story to be interesting. This is a story Rich Kramer reported on this week. Apparently, a drone which was flying over a Chippewa County frac sand mine earlier this month made a soft landing on the property. And when the owner went to retrieve it, he was kicked out. Now, the owner was taking pictures of the mine at the time of the drone, which landed on the property. The sand company is hoping charges are brought against the owner of the drone. The company says he was both trespassing and illegally using the drone.
So when we say a soft landing, what does that mean?
It means it lost power for some reason and it landed. I wouldn't necessarily say it crashed, but it lost power and it landed on the mine property.
And why do you think this is kind of a big deal, Noah?
I mentioned the story because it could be really an early test of a state law that was passed last year that actually prohibits drones from recording people when they have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Now, the sand company argues, this is a slippery slope. The case in question involves a mine, but later, they argue, it could involve somebody's backyard. So that's why I think this is a big deal. Again, this is really could potentially be a test of this new law and, could go to really define really how drones can be used in the state.
Right. So some interesting issues there. We're going to have to watch that one and see which way it goes.
Yeah, I'll be paying attention. That's for sure. And of course, I'm a geek, so I'm a sucker for anything drone related. So,
all right. Well, we'll keep an eye on it. Noah, thanks a lot for stopping by. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. It was good to be here.
That was WPR's Assistant News Director Noah Ovshinsky covering the biggest stories from around the state this week in our Wisconsin News Roundup. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. This weekend marks the 25th anniversary of the beginning of the broadcast run of the hit 90s TV sitcom Seinfeld. The show followed the everyday exploits of Jerry, George, Elaine, and Kramer as they waded their way through the mindless minutiae of life. Seinfeld became known affectionately as a show about nothing. Joining us now to talk about the show's continuing influence on TV is Robert Thompson, professor of television and pop culture at Syracuse University. Robert, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So how did Seinfeld change the way TV sitcoms are produced?
Well, it took a little while, and it wasn't the first to do a lot of what it did. I mean, this whole show about nothing is a misnomer. It wasn't about nothing. It was about a lot of things. It just tended to be more these daily details of life, and that came from the fact that television was more and more tapping stand-up comedians who did that kind of observational humor. And Seinfeld wasn't the first to do that. Cosby had 5 years in a row as the number one Nielsen-rated guy. Doing that same kind of thing, and when 30-something first proposed its show, it used the phrase a show about nothing before Seinfeld started referring to his show about that. So it wasn't like he did anything new, and when that show started, it took a little while to get going. But once it started firing on all cylinders, there was no stopping it. It gave a whole new vocabulary to the kinds of things we all experienced and thought about, but didn't necessarily put a specific word to yet.
So is that what sets it apart? I mean, given that it did become this juggernaut, but you say it wasn't necessarily first in being a show about nothing, is there anything that we can point to that's and say, this is vintage Seinfeld and only Seinfeld did this?
Well, I suppose you don't need me to say that one of the reasons this worked is it was a combination of really good writing and really good performances. I'm not sure I'd actually say in all cases it was great acting, because Seinfeld is not a great actor. He's a great performer. He was a great he was great in that show. But combined, those four really worked. And I think it's when they started systematically doing those episodes, waiting for food for an entire episode in a Chinese restaurant, getting a car stuck in or losing their car in a mall multiple level parking garage, which is like a retelling of Dante's Inferno in a half hour sitcom, and then giving words to things like in the contest, are you master of your domain? A polite way to say something that everybody likes to talk about at some point but didn't have a polite way of doing it. That great episode where they came up with the not that there's anything wrong with that as a blanket apology that what you're about to say may be perceived as offensive, but it shouldn't be. That was really useful in the 1990s.
And the other thing about this is these characters, they weren't that glamorous, or they didn't have incredible sex appeal or charisma. They were kind of, in fact, in George's case, George was a loser. Here's a little clip of vintage George.
Right.
Every decision I've ever made in my entire life has been wrong. My life is the complete opposite of everything I want it to be.
George, you know that woman just looked at you. Go talk to her.
Yeah, I should do the opposite. I should.
If every instinct you have is wrong, then the opposite would have to be right.
Yes. I will do the opposite. Excuse me, I couldn't help but notice that you were looking in my direction.
Oh, yes, I was. You just ordered the same exact lunch as me.
My name is George. I'm unemployed and I live with my parents.
I'm Victoria. Hi.
George Costanza doing the lovable loser thing there. What do you think about George being lovable?
Well, he was, and of course he gave hope to many, many people because George had a lot of women that he went out with that looked like they would have never in a million years given a guy like George the time of day. But when you go right down that cast, George, of course, spent on and off living with his parents. Kramer, while he was kind of appealing in some ways, looked like he just landed from the planet Neptune. Elaine, of course, was an attractive woman, but not in the conventional sorts of ways that we think of necessarily. She couldn't dance. She was kind of awkward. Jerry, I guess his appeal came from the fact that he was in show business. And on top of that, not only were they're these physical issues, they were in many ways really unlikable characters. That's what that whole final episode was all about when they finally put them in jail, where many people thought they belonged.
Did you think that was a good ending?
Well, a lot of people didn't. I thought it was really beautiful. I mean, the fact that those very final lines were repeating lines from the very first season, the very first episode, bringing us into this continual loop. I think it was a nice final scene. I think that episode was too long. I think that whole business with Geraldo and the court case and all the rest of it was a little much. But at that point, they were trying to top everything they'd done at that point, and they were their own toughest act to follow.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about some of the expressions and concepts that the show was responsible for bringing out into the pop culture lexicon. What are some of your favorites? You mentioned not that there's anything wrong with that. What else?
Yeah, I mean, I have used that a lot in that I think that really became handy in an era of heightened sensibility and heightened raised consciousnesses and all of that. It was a way of sort of saying that you were on the side of all of that. Shrinkage, of course, was fun. Yada yada, Seinfeld gets credit for. Yada yada had been in the language before Seinfeld, but they really brought it to the forefront. Double dipping, sponge-worthy. I mean, this show, Different Strokes gave us What You Talking About, Willis. Seinfeld gave us 10 or 12 really enduring kind of cultural idioms.
And since you mentioned the yada yada thing.
You don't think she'd yada yada sex?
I've yada yadded sex.
Really?
Yeah. I met this lawyer. We went out to dinner. I had the lobster bisque. We went back to my place. Yada yada yada. I never heard from him again.
But you yada yadded over the best part.
No, I mentioned the bisque.
clip there from the hit TV show Seinfeld, which is observing its 25th anniversary of the beginning of the broadcast run. We're talking with TV and pop culture critic Robert Thompson from Syracuse University. And what do you think about the staying power of this show? It's been picked up by Hulu for a fee of $1 million per episode. Why is this show still so, I guess, relevant?
Right, all nine seasons. Well, I guess part of it is the fact that it did so much define the culture of the 1990s that subsequent people who haven't seen it really, I think, feel the need to go back. And it's one of the Rosetta Stones of understanding a lot of emerging culture. But the other thing, and a recent article in the New York Times talked about this, Seinfeld, of course, comes out in first debuts in 1989. The internet is not, is just beginning to start having the its embryonic stages. But it's amazing how when you play a clip like you just did, and in fact, all the clips you played so far, they are so internet-friendly, even though they were made before the era of that. That little clip, you didn't have to know any of those characters. You didn't have to know anything about the show. That little 30 seconds works completely on its own. And now, of course, we're in an era that so much of what we consume are in these tiny little bites. I mean, in the age of the internet, 3 minutes is the new War and Peace. And Seinfeld, ahead of its time, really worked on that modular kind of level. And I think that's why it's still appealing. You watch an old classic episode of the Beverly Hillbillies, and you've kind of got to let the story develop. Seinfeld, every 30 seconds, it rewards you, even if you haven't seen anything that came before.
Do you think that it appeals to the younger generation, to the 20-somethings, teenagers, or are the people watching it, like people like me, the nostalgic Gen Xers or baby boomers?
Well, that's a really interesting point because I've noticed a change. I mean, I am constantly exposed to 18 to 22-year-olds because I keep getting older and my students keep remaining the same age. And while Seinfeld was on, it was one of the favorite shows of my students. For about a decade after it was on, it remained one of their favorites and they got to know it in syndication. I've noticed in the past 5 or 6 years, however, that I'm getting more and more of a vibe from certain students that Seinfeld is one of those shows that their parents watched. And that's a very kind of depressing thought to me, but I think we're beginning to see that movement of Seinfeld into the classic TV arena. Doesn't mean that they don't still appreciate it and they don't still like it and they don't still like it when some reference to it is made in an episode of Family Guy. But let's face it, it's become an older show. And for that matter, the characters themselves weren't exactly young when they were in that show.
Yeah, this is true. They were older. Not older, but they were middle-aged-ish. They were
way too old to be acting the way they did on that program.
In a way, right. And they wore these plain clothes. Jerry seemed like a super nerd in a way with his prim little button-up shirts. I don't know. Was that an attempt by them to make it sort of evergreen, or were these just not fancy people?
Well, I mean, again, another good point. It does have an evergreen quality in that while there's a lot about it that shouts out the 90s, for example, the big telephones with the antennas coming out and all the rest of it, it does have a certain I Love Lucy quality. I Love Lucy obviously looks old because it's in black and white and their hairstyles are different, but there's not a lot, like if you watch an episode of Miami Vice or $16 Million Man, you can barely watch it because it's so anachronistic. Seinfeld has got a certain, it's almost as though it could have taken place in any time because in so many ways it wasn't taking place at any specific time in particular.
And another thing about the show, it seems like it's one of the first ones, at least that I can think of, that made you feel at times uncomfortable while you watched it. Was that something that was original about it, that this was ushering in the era of uncomfortable comedy shows like The Office?
It was ahead of its time, and there had been a few others. I don't know if you remember a syndicated show called Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman, mm-hmm. which Norman Lear did, and that had those moments of real extreme discomfort. But Seinfeld, you're right, brought that into a whole new era where you're almost watching thinking, no, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that, and then of course the character does it. And of course, Larry David would then take that idea from Seinfeld, which he co-created, to Curb Your Enthusiasm, which was one of the most deliciously, unpleasantly uncomfortable programs to watch to this very day.
And you know who we haven't talked about yet? We really have to give Kramer his due. What do you think about the role of Kramer?
Well, I mean, if Kramer hadn't gotten caught making those extraordinarily horrid racist remarks in the Laugh Factory in L.A., I think we would be celebrating him as one of the greatest comic second banana characters of all time. And I guess we still have to give him that. Kramer helped make that show. That show without Kramer would have been a very different show and a very much not as good show. Though I have to say, once that those clips of his tirade came out on YouTube, it to this day is hard for me to watch Seinfeld, see Kramer come in, and not think of that tirade. It has really put a cloud over that program that has lasted for a long time.
You know, it's funny you mention that. I had forgotten that, and now that you mention it, it's once something happens, it's difficult to go back and see it the same way. But given all that, as we wrap up here, Robert, is Seinfeld, in your opinion, the greatest TV comedy of all time, as some have called it? And we'll never know because we lost Robert Thompson. Well, I guess you can answer that question for yourself. I'm going to say, yeah, I think it was one of my favorite shows. Maybe one day we'll find out what Robert Thompson thinks. Robert Thompson is professor of television and pop culture at Syracuse University. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is back on Monday. Time now for Food Friday. As we head into the month of June, temperatures continuing to heat up. It's finally starting to feel a little bit like summer. For our next guest, that means one thing, homemade ice cream. She's with us now to talk about how to craft the perfect treat for a warm summer day and to share a few memories, too. Anna Thomas Bates is a freelance writer who blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com. She also writes a weekly column for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's food section and a column for Edible Madison. Anna, thanks a lot for being back with us.
Thanks for having me.
So homemade ice cream is a topic that seems like it's pretty near and dear to your heart because it comes wrapped in all these cherished family traditions for you. What do you remember about homemade ice cream when you were growing up?
Well, food memories are the strongest memories, and my memories of ice cream are all wrapped up in summer and family. For every major summer holiday, Memorial Day, 4th of July, birthdays, we almost all had summer birthdays. My dad would get out his old school ice cream maker with the rock salt and the ice, and he would make homemade ice cream, and that's what we had for every summer holiday.
Wow. So what kinds of things did you make in that one?
You know, our favorite was the one that I published in my column a few weeks ago, and it was from the booklet that came with the ice cream maker, and it was called Country Time Vanilla. And it was pretty much just a straight-shooting vanilla ice cream recipe, and it was delicious, and that's the one we had most often. However, a few other members of the family had favorites, and we would sometimes make chocolate, lemon, or coconut were the three others we made frequently.
And nowadays, there are a lot more options when it comes to homemade ice cream makers besides the rock salt ones. There's the ones where you have to turn the crank to make it. What do you recommend if you want to make homemade ice cream?
Yeah, the most popular and one of the easiest is the kind that has a bowl that you keep in the freezer, and it has a gel inside that freezes. And what you do is you put that in the machine, you pour the batter into that refreezable bowl, and in about 30 minutes you have ice cream ready to go. You just have to plan a little bit ahead because you do have to freeze that bowl solid ahead of time.
Do you get different results if you want to use something that's lower tech?
You know, there's a couple different ways. If you don't have an ice cream machine at all, it gets a little trickier to make ice cream because a big part of that is churning it and getting the air mixed in. But at summer camp, we used to do a kick-the-can ice cream where we would put our ice cream batter in a small tin can, like a small coffee can, tape it up and seal it really well, and then put it inside a larger can with ice and rock salt, so mimicking that old-school ice cream maker, and then we kicked it all around. until it was done.
Did that work?
It, you know, it's probably not as nice a result, but it sure is a good time.
Well, now that you're grown up, you've got a child of your own, how are you creating similar memories?
So one of my kids, my 7-year-old or almost 7-year-old, he decided that we should start having Sundays. And it's a pretty great suggestion. And so I think once school is out, we are going to do that. So we'll have a different kind of ice cream each week and a couple fun toppings, and we'll have Sundays. So it's something that I think we'll do during the summer, and it's all wrapped up with fireflies and swimming pools, and it's just those types of things that kids look back fondly on.
What do you think it is about having these food traditions that stay with us when we grow up?
I think it's that they're multi-sensory. You know, you've got the taste, you've got a smell, and that's tied together with whatever was happening at that time, and those things just make it really concrete and really tangible. I think you can eat ice cream or smell a lemon or whatever your memories are years later and come right back to that, you know, poolside 4th of July with your family.
So if we do want to go this route and make our own homemade ice cream, what are some things that the homemade stuff has going for it that the regular boxed ice cream might not?
Sure. I mean, there's really good stuff available these days, but they're really expensive. And the ice creams that are available at the store that are less expensive often have a lot more stabilizers and additives in them, things to keep them, you know, soft and creamy and on the shelf for a long time. So with your own ice cream recipe, and there's a couple different ways you can go, but you know, a simple way is really just milk, cream, and sugar and any flavorings that you want, and that's going to make a pretty decent ice cream. The one that I published has the addition of a few eggs. They aren't cooked, so it's still a very easy recipe to put together, but it has a little bit more richness to it. And then you can get really fancy as well and add things like cream cheese and cornstarch, which are kind of home-style additives that keep your ice cream really supple and really creamy for a long time. A lot of times homemade ice cream will get icy after a few days in the freezer.
So cream cheese and cornstarch. So does it taste tangy like cream cheese does?
No, these are the secrets of Jenny Britton Bauer of Jenny's Splendid Ice Creams out of Ohio, and she's kind of an ice cream goddess. And she published a James Beard award-winning cookbook a few years ago called Jenny's Splendid Ice Creams at Home. And she uses these tactics of, it's just a little bit of cream cheese. I want to say it's like 2 ounces for the whole batch, and a little bit of cornstarch. And it just, she gives you the scientific explanation, but it has to do with not letting those water crystals and sugar crystals turn icy. Just that added fat, that added casein keeps everything really supple and creamy.
And let's say we want to go with the sort of custardy thing that you mentioned where you use eggs and you sort of make a custard before you add your cream and stuff. How does that work?
Sure. So we're in Wisconsin, so we have to know how to make custard. Essentially, what you'll do is you warm up your milk and cream and sugar mixture, and then you have some eggs whisked off to the sides, and you pour a little bit of that warm mixture into the eggs to temper them so they don't scramble. Whisk it in, and then whisk in a little bit more till you're slowly bringing up the temperature of those eggs. Then you combine it all together and cook it till it just comes to a boil and it thickens, and that's your custard base. And then you'd put that, after it's well chilled, into the ice cream maker.
And what did you say the difference would be versus the one where you don't have the egg custard and it's just more about the cream and the sugar?
Yeah, it's still delicious. It just isn't cooked eggs. So I think it's a lot simpler, but, you know, some people are a little wary of eating uncooked eggs. In that case, you can either go the custard route and cook your eggs, or you could seek out pasteurized eggs.
Now let's talk a little bit more about that recipe that your dad used to make, because that was a very simple one. Tell us a little bit about where that recipe came from for your family.
Yeah, so we had this little rock salt ice maker. It was electric. It wasn't a hand crank one, but it made a couple quarts of ice cream, and this came with the booklet. It was called Country Time Vanilla, and it is milk, cream, eggs, sugar, a lot of vanilla, and a tiny pinch of salt. So you can whisk up that batter in just minutes and have it ready to go. And then it needs to go into the fridge for a few hours to chill, and then you can go ahead and churn it.
And did you use just plain old vanilla extract? Did you get fancy and use a vanilla bean? What do you recommend?
I use vanilla extract most of the time, but if I do, you know, if I am lucky and have a vanilla bean, you certainly could do that. Scrape out the vanilla bean seams, and it would be superb.
I always think that I should like the vanilla bean taste more, but on the few occasions when I've gone and bought one, I'm always surprised, and I feel like the vanilla bean tastes like fake vanilla instead of the vanilla extract.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good one, but we do have this recipe that your family loves up on the Central Time Facebook page right now. If people are interested in checking that out. And I mean, the fact is probably most of us want to get a little fancier with our ice cream, unless we're doing the sundaes like you were talking about. What do you recommend for additions to ice cream, especially if you've got like a nice vanilla like that?
Sure. If you've got some ice cream ready to go, there are all sorts of things you can do. One of our favorites are just a basic ice cream sandwich. So you get your favorite cookies, you put the ice cream in the middle, squish it down, wrap those up, and you can store those in the freezer, and they're outstanding. And I love to use different kinds of cookies. So we'll do a fruit-flavored ice cream like strawberry or raspberry or orange sherbet and use sugar cookies. Or vanilla ice cream with chocolate chip cookies is always delicious, too.
Well, we're talking right now with food writer Anna Thomas Bates about homemade ice cream. We're getting into the homemade ice cream season as the weather warms up. And we want to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. Do you have childhood memories of warm days, maybe homemade ice cream? And do you have a favorite recipe that you turn back to? What about favorite additions to ice cream, toppings, things like cookies to put into your homemade vanilla ice cream? Is this something you do with your family? Call 800-642-1234 or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Today on Food Friday, we're welcoming in summer with a look at how to make homemade ice cream. Our guest is Anna Thomas Bates of Tallgrass Kitchen, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What about you? Do you make homemade ice cream in your home? And what do you prefer? Do you like the custard kind we were talking about with eggs? Do you like to keep it a little more streamlined? And what do you like to add in? What about kids? Did they enjoy making it with you? And what memories do you have of summertime homemade ice cream? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we go to our callers now. We have Josh with us in Eau Claire. Hi, Josh.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment and say that one of my favorite things to add to ice cream is just some good old-fashioned homemade Wisconsin maple syrup from a sugar bush.
And do you put it on vanilla?
Yeah, I love putting it on vanilla, especially homemade ice cream. And it's got to be the real stuff. It's got to be cooked with the same wood that came out of the forest where the maple trees produce the sap. And I have some warm memories of that because my great uncle actually has a sugar bush and just outside of Chippewa Falls, and he continues to make maple syrup all the way up into his 90-year-old part of his life.
Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you, Josh. Appreciate you calling up and sharing that. I have had that once at a maple syrup festival, and I have to say it was really delicious, but it's not really a mainstream thing. What do you think about that one, Anna?
We've actually done it, too. I don't know if it's a Wisconsin thing, but it is. It's a very nice topping. It adds a lot of, you know, smoke and sweetness, and it's delicious.
And you can probably just use the syrup to make a maple-flavored ice cream, right?
You could. You have to be careful when you're adding things into the actual recipe. If you add things in that have water, it can make it icy. So you'd have to even reduce it a little bit, I think, and make it a little bit thicker.
All right. Well, that's a great suggestion. Very Wisconsin-y. We're going to go next to Leslie joining us in Green Bay. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I've always been known for my sweet tooth and how much I've loved ice cream growing up. But the last few years, I've been eating animal product free. And I was wondering if Anna had any suggestions on maybe how to make an ice cream that doesn't include dairy for people who are maybe lactose intolerant or don't eat animal products for whatever reason.
Okay, great. Thank you for the question, Leslie. And Anna, what do you think about that? Thoughts?
I do, Leslie. It's funny, my dad, the one who made us ice cream the whole time growing up, he's now a vegan. He's been a vegan going on 4 years now. So when we have family get-togethers now, we always make sure we have dessert options for him because he also has a sweet tooth. So a while ago, I published a peanut butter vegan ice cream recipe that was based on a woman's cookbook, and her name's escaping me now. But basically, I used peanut butter. I used peanuts. I made my own peanut butter, mixed it with rice milk and a few other things. And if you go to my column online, you can find it. But using nut butters and non-dairy milks can put together a pretty decent ice cream. Coconut milk is another great option. Coconut milk and rice milk are my two favorites. Coconut milk for its richness and its flavor, and rice milk because it's one of the milks you can find that doesn't have a lot of additives in it. And both of them make a nice ice cream when combined with some other delicious ingredients.
Well, Leslie, thank you so much for that call, and good luck with your dairy-free ice cream. And you can join us right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 as we talk the joys of homemade ice cream. Want to know what your traditions are, your favorite flavors, your hits, your misses, and what you like best about making homemade ice cream in the summertime. And we're going to go next to Jody. Jody's joining us in La Crosse. Hi, Jody.
Hey, my daughter convinced me to buy one of the she was talking about with the thing that you put in the freezer and freeze up, and then you pour your stuff in there and mix it. And it cost $3, and I wasn't even sure it was going to work, but they used it all the time. I mean, they loved it, and they got along, and they made so many different flavors, and they used almond milk and rice milk and everything. So, like, it was for that last question. The vegan options are unlimited. It's crazy. But they used it so much they broke the handle off, and I cannot find another one. And I was hoping maybe she knew where I could get another one.
Ah, good question. Thanks, Jody. Anna?
Was it one of those small hand-cranked ones?
Yes.
You know, I had one of those growing up, and I have not seen them around since. But last year, a couple different companies came out with other options. One was kind of a big plate that was made out of that same material that you'd put in the freezer, and you'd pour the batter right in, and then you kind of did some scraping, and you stirred it, and it would freeze along the bottom. Then you would scrape it up and turn it over. So it was the same idea. It was very fast. It was very hands-on and pretty basic. And I don't remember the company, but maybe I can get it to Veronica, and we could put it on the Facebook page. But there are a couple different options, not the same as the hand crank, but just as much fun, I would think.
Well, good luck, Jody, and I'm glad they got so much enjoyment out of that one. And there are some different options out there if you poke around a little, and I'd be happy to have us post that if you give us the information. Now, it seems like lately people are really pushing the limits when it comes to flavors. People are putting bacon in everything, sriracha in everything. What do you think about getting really crazy with your homemade ice cream? Have you tried anything like that?
We haven't gone too crazy. We're pretty traditional, I'd say, and this really isn't crazy, but it was delicious. We did a rhubarb crisp ice cream where we stirred in, after the ice cream was made, kind of a ribbon of rhubarb compote and then actual crisp topping, and just mixed it all together. Mm. So if you like it and you think it would complement a sweet flavor, you should go for it. Jenny Britton Bauer, the woman I spoke about before, actually has some ice cream or sorbets made from sour Belgian beer, so the type that New Glarus Brewery makes, the cherry tart and the raspberry. She has a recipe to turn those into ice creams, which sounds actually pretty refreshing.
Another thing I've always wanted to try, kind of similar to that, is to infuse tea into my ice cream.
Yeah,
that's
a great idea. I've done a green tea. I've mixed in some matcha powder, but also we'll steep mint leaves in overnight. We'll just make the batter, steep the mint leaves overnight, and I don't see why you couldn't do the same with tea leaves.
That does sound good. Maybe this year will be the year I try that one.
Chai tea sounds really good, doesn't it?
It does. That would be fantastic. Well, once you've got your ice cream, you've done the hard work of making the ice cream, what do you suggest for other toppings? We talked maple syrup, but what else?
You know, of course, hot fudge and caramel are great. There's all sorts of fruit, all the beautiful summer Wisconsin fruits, that you can just cook them down a little bit and make them into sort of a compote. The strawberries, the raspberries, the tart cherries are all really fantastic.
We've got another caller here. We're going to go next to Tracy in Milwaukee. Tracy, hi.
Hi. I just recently tried balsamic vinegar on ice cream, and that was a very unique and actually delicious combination.
Balsamic vinegar. Okay, was it just added to vanilla, or was the whole ice cream flavored with balsamic?
No, it actually was it's added to a topping. It was served over vanilla ice cream, and so I think it was like a blackberry vinaigrette, balsamic vinegar. And there's quite a few different flavors out there that really add some dimension to an ice cream.
Gotcha. Well, thank you, Tracy. That's an unusual one, but there's some balsamic vinegars can get really sweet, almost syrupy.
They can, but they're still going to retain their tartness, which is really a nice balance to some really sweet ice cream.
And Anna, I know you've got some cool ideas about how to serve ice cream outside of the standard choices like bowls or cones. What do you think?
Well, floats are always a fun idea, and, you know, we have the traditional root beer float, but you can also do a Guinness float with like a dark chocolate ice cream, or you can do vanilla ice cream in one of those tart Belgian beers I was talking about. Or if you want to be really fancy, you could put a little scoop of sorbet into some champagne or Prosecco.
Wow.
Or a fancy dinner party.
Have you done all these things before?
I've done several of them. And our other favorite thing is to make an ice cream bombe, B-O-M-B-E, where you layer different flavors into a bowl or a loaf pan. You put in one layer, freeze it for a little bit, another layer with a different flavor, and keep layering till you get to the top and then freeze the whole thing and unmold it, and then you have a cake that you can slice up.
Ah, well, that would be nice. And then do you serve anything with it, little cookies? Or
a little cookie, a little crunch is always nice.
What about your kids? What do they like best?
You know, they're pretty easy to please. If you give them ice cream, they really like cones. Cones are an important part of the process here, and sometimes we get really geeky and we actually make our own ice cream cones. And they love that crunch and that sweetness along with the ice cream.
How do you make your own ice cream cone? I'm thinking especially about how you get the little diamond shapes into it.
Sure. To actually get the diamond shape in there, you need a special waffle iron. So it's similar to making waffles, but it's very, very thin. And we do have one of those because, like I said, we're into this ice cream thing. But you can do something similar where you pour out, it's a very thin batter, you pour it into a circle and then bake it in the oven. So a little trickier, but you don't need the equipment. And then while it's still warm, you roll it into either the cone shape, or if you put it into a bowl, you can mold it into a bowl shape.
Is it worth it? It's one of those things where it sounds great, but is it going to be worth our time? Can you taste it, the difference?
Yes, and your whole house smells amazing. If you walk into one of those ice cream shops where they're making their own waffle cones, I mean, you just get that rich vanilla cone smell, and it's pretty darn good. We won't be doing that every week, but every once in a while, it's a fun treat.
Wow. So the final question, when will you be inviting the Central Time crew to your house for ice cream?
Oh, you guys are welcome anytime. We'll have a whole Sunday bar set up for you.
Well, Anna, thank you so much. Lots of great ideas to get our ice cream on this summer.
Thanks, Veronica.
We've been talking to Anna Thomas Bates. She is a freelance writer who blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com. She also writes a weekly column for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's food section and a column for Edible Madison. She joined us to talk about homemade ice cream. And don't forget, we've got one of her family recipes for a basic, yummy vanilla ice cream over on the Central Time Facebook page. If you love reality TV, this coming Sunday, May 31st, is a big day. It marks the 15th anniversary of a TV show that changed the landscape of TV watching forever, the show Survivor. Survivor was the prototype reality show. The contestants lived on a deserted island, competed for $1 million of prize money. And the show was the brainchild of producer Mark Burnett, and it spawned a whole reality show paradise on TV that's still going on today. And who can forget moments from that first season, like, I guess, the guy who walked around without clothes on in season one? Some people here at WPR remember that. I don't know for what reason. And also Susan Hawk, one of the first finalists, was from Palmyra, Wisconsin. Here was one of her big speeches from the show.
This island is pretty much full of only two things, snakes and rats. And in the end of Mother Nature, we have Richard the Snake, who knowingly went after prey, and Kelly, who turned into the rat that ran around like the rats do on this island, trying to run from the snake. I feel we owe it to the island's spirits that we have learned to come to know, to let it be in the end the way Mother Nature intended it to be, for the snake to eat the rat.
That was Susan Hawk from Survivor. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is back on Monday. You're listening to Central Times right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. There's more to come.